Welcome to Warships Pod, and our guests today are David Blagden, an associate professor at the University of Exeter, and who has been on before, and global forecaster David Murren, investor, polymath, and author of Breaking the Code of History. He has a talent for spotting and analysing deep-seated patterns in history and using them to try and understand the present and also where we might be going in today's turbulent geopolitical scene. Welcome, gents.
Hi there.
Hi, Ian.
I thought I'd start off by explaining for the listeners as much as for us that the aim today or on this episode is to try and divine what is happening and where things are likely heading in a tripolar world where the big players are in the USA under Donald Trump, China under Xi Jinping, and Russia led by Vladimir Putin. But of course, wherever we can with a naval geopolitical slant. So I wonder if you could give your perspectives on the following, and for the ease of listeners understanding what's going on, we've got David M, David Murren, and David Blagden. So I'll start off with, if I may, David B, should we say David B, that's David Blagden. And do you think, David B, that the EU has a place in such a world at the top table, or is it going to be sweeping up the crumbs along with the UK, you know, the latter finding itself as a bit of a bridge to neither the USA or the EU? What do you think?
I mean, yes, I think it does have an important position. It slightly depends what you mean when you talk about the EU, right? So the major powers within the EU, you know, particularly France and Germany, and then, you know, whether we talk about the UK as well, no longer an EU member, but increasingly a lot realigned with the European position because of what's going on in the wider world. Then, yeah, I mean, they're important major powers in what remains one of the world's most important regions. So in that sense, yes, you know, they're much bigger, more developed economies than somewhere like Russia, for example. You know, Russia is a country that allocates a large amount of its economic output and broader national activity to trying to project power and act like a great power. But its actual sort of base in terms of economic productivity, technology, is not a peer of those European countries. But you're also right at the same time that certainly the EU, when we think about it as a collective, is a rather sort of hamstrung entity because of the divergence of interests within it. And you are also right that if we are moving towards a world of, you know, the United States and China locked in some sort of bipolar competition, Russia not at that same level, but throwing its weight around a lot and trying to project as much power as it can, and potentially India maybe ascending ultimately to that US-China kind of tier in terms of economic output, then that will be a world in which, you know, European powers are not, I mean, you know, so it's top table is a metaphor, right? You know, but are not as globally consequential, certainly.
And what do you think, David M?
Well, to answer your question, I just want to sort of reframe how we see the architecture of the world. I think you've got an axis of autocracy that's centered around China with three clear spokes: Iran, North Korea, and Russia. And none of the shenanigans with Russia or Iran would be taking place if the center of the hub hadn't reached a point of parity with America in terms of to challenge it. So the real mover here is China in the middle. In the Western world, obviously, we've got what I call the American shadow system. It's a shadow empire of extraction of wealth from the periphery, uses a defense envelope, and it uses a dollar footprint to do that. And Europe has sat neatly in that military umbrella as an economic power of, you know, 10, 20 years ago, it was close enough. It's now 50% smaller, but it has completely forgotten to defend itself and forgotten to invest in its insurance policy. And we've moved into a new age of conflict, and the new age of conflict is about military power. As such, if you don't have military power, you are vulnerable to the influences of others. So within that context, the EU is fairly toothless. I mean, it's lovely talking about spending 800 billion euros, but it's got to actually manifest those euros into defense capability before it reaches the table. And the only thing within the European construct that gives a voice to Britain and France is our nuclear capability. So in terms of that framework, we now have another complexity. Somewhere in the top, the center of the axis of democracy or allies for democracy has suddenly turned to an affiliation for someone on the other side. And it's really confused us because it was a difficult enough scenario with a straight face-off. But now we've got the complexities of a wedge being driven between Europe and America. And that wedge complicates and really separates and divides the democratic response to this challenge by autocracy, which is now going kinetic. Make no mistake, when you two spokes out of three and the hub is ready for it, we're in a kinetic world. So if we want a seat at the table, we're going to have to do a lot more than talk about increasing our defense capability. We really have to go to emergency economic and military structures, as we did in the First and Second World War, because this isn't something of the future that's coming to us in 5 or 3 years. It's with us right now and around the corner. So until we start thinking like that and start manifesting really clear political intention, our seat is going to be a very secondary seat compared to the way the big powers respond and try and shape policy for everyone else.
And David B, I know you're a person with a specialization or a special understanding of nuclear forces and or considering them and how they work within everything else. Do you think there's a danger of some elements of European military power, such as the UK, for example, who think that what they have to contribute is the nuclear bit and they don't adequately boost the conventional deterrent? Is that something that worries you?
It does worry me, yeah. In particular, that particularly the UK, but also France, to a somewhat lesser extent, have got themselves into a situation of really quite denuded conventional forces, and then a huge yawning gap up to strategic nuclear forces. And certainly when you talk about some of the commitments that, you know, if the US is now less committed to European defence, you talk about some of the commitments that the likes of Britain and France are trying to take on in terms of extended deterrence and things like that, you could quite easily have a situation where European conventional forces prove inadequate at some quite lowish level, and suddenly you're left with some pretty unpalatable options that include sort of a massive attempted rearmament effort, conscription, whatever, in the face of Russian aggression trying to run it really at great pace in a not very conducive manner, or conceding that NATO and the rest of it is broadly shattered, or escalating to nuclear brinksmanship with strategic nuclear forces. So yeah, that absolutely is a concern. I mean, it's also a concern even when we look at nuclear forces themselves. You sort of pitched it as conventional versus nuclear, and that is right. But also, you know, the UK in particular has only strategic retaliatory weapons, right? Well, I mean, that's not quite true. You can use a Trident warhead or a Trident missile in a sub-strategic role if you want to, but it would be a tremendously dangerous thing to do because you'd be firing a submarine-launched ballistic missile that the Russians would then detect, and you'd be having to sort of say, trust us, you know, this isn't the opening salvo of a massive first strike. This is just us doing some, you know, limited operational nuclear strike or whatever. So that would be highly risky. I mean, at least France still has its 54... pre-strategic nuclear weapons, they call it, you know, effectively tactical nuclear weapons for signalling on the sort of escalatory ladder. The UK doesn't have anything there either. So again, if the US is less committed to European defence and therefore US tactical nuclear weapons are no longer fully committed to European defence, the UK and France might have a gap there too, as well as you rightly point out, this sort of yawning gap between pretty diminished conventional forces and strategic nuclear retaliation.
The thing that worries me is that, of course, you use one tactical nuclear weapon. And David M., if you could come in on this after I've just waffled on a bit here. You use one tactical nuclear weapon, which is a pretty big weapon by any measure, and then it mushrooms and then it just escalates straight away. And I suppose a nightmare scenario that could occur is that if Britain commits its what remains of its armed forces to policing a frozen war in Ukraine, or rather in Ukraine, you could run a situation where what's left of the British Army is bogged down and other armies such as the French, because the Poles don't want to do it and the Italians don't want to do it. So it could be a fairly small force facing quite a lot of critical mass still in the Russian military, and therefore they get eviscerated, and then it's straight to as David B just said, it's straight up the ladder to tactical, then potentially, you know, trying to deter things with a strategic weapon. So David, and then David M, and then David B, I'd just like to get your opinions on the whole committing the British Army, what's left of it, and also other NATO militaries to this cold, rather frozen war scenario, where they're expected to police a so-called ceasefire line, where I'm pretty sure the Russians would do everything they could with all their various capabilities, grey, hybrid and conventional, to bleed that force and also provoke it. So what do you think to that that idea?
Well, going back to also, I completely agree with David about the issues about nuclear weapons. Really, we have lost the art of full-spectrum deterrence, and that is the idea that at every level, when you're challenged by an adversary, you can match it. If you don't match it, they get to escalate it, and then it's a battle of wills and intentions. And so far, if you look at the display of European leaders and our intention to support Ukraine, if I was assessing us on the other side, I think there's a good chance that we'd balk at the use of retaliatory nuclear weapons. So that just moves you right up through the curve with no gaps. I think the thing that's also that integrates into your question is we are focusing on Russia. And our belated defense plans look at, you know, Russia's challenges in Ukraine. And yes, you know, the speed at which we see it building up to be a threat to the core European countries. But I think that's a miscalculation, because Russia is a spoke of China's arms. And China is going to war in the Asian basin, and Taiwan is part of it. And the moment that flashpoint happens, we will see millions of Chinese forces join the Russians. So the calculus that we can allow our rate of military expansion to match what we think the Russians is fundamentally flawed, which goes back to the next question, which you asked about, should we forward deploy British troops? And I think watching Starmer discuss this so, you know, enthusiastically is a fascinating example of someone who's failed and neglected defense systematically and continually. And then suddenly, just like Blair before, is ready to commit our forces, which ultimately overbalances us. Our army is minuscule. And if you look at the history of BEFs in the First World War and Second World War, they didn't fare very well because they were usually positioned politically. And we couldn't even get them back from France in both cases. We were very lucky. In the First World War, most of them were destroyed in the opening period, although they made the typical balancing change in the Battle for Paris and the reversal. In the Second World War, they just got crushed as the defensive lines collapsed. So I think if we put anyone in the forward sense forward, we become overextended. And I don't think troops are the answer. I think if we're going to do anything that tips a balance in Ukraine, whether it's in peace or actually more aggressively to say end the war, we should be using a European air shield. If it's supplemented by the Americans, it would be overwhelming. Even without the Americans, I believe it would still dominate the battlefield. It's the one thing the Ukrainians miss. And most of the advances which have taken place in the past year have been glide bombs. If you push the glide bombs back, actually this three-phase advance and tactics the Russians have been using wouldn't have worked. So they lack air power, and NATO has air power advantage. So boots on the ground is really a metaphor for the past. How can a few of our troops strengthen a force which has been at battle for 3 years, is fully adapted, uses frontline drone technology, and when we don't even have it in our forces? So we're living in cuckoo land.
David, David B, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I broadly agree that there's a lot of potential trade-offs here. So, you know, the case in favor, if someone were to make it, would be a UK and French ground presence in particular is that thing that means the Russians can't, because this is all premised on a ceasefire in which the Russians actually, you know, a ceasefire actually happening, and the Russians being willing to concede a ceasefire on the premise that European NATO troops are then going to arrive in Ukraine. So those are a couple of big assumptions, yeah, and quite a big couple of big hurdles to clear in the first place anyway. This whole conversation might be hypothetical. But, you know, if it were to become unhypothetical, then, you know, the case in favour would be that the UK and France being there means that Russian ground forces can't renew their ground assault without coming into contact with NATO forces, which would introduce this extra element of risk into their thinking that it would become a NATO involved war. So then that would then bring in the European NATO states' air power and things like that. And again, you know, the case in favor would be that the UK and France are the two in a best position to do that, A, because they're they have the most potent deterrent against retaliatory attacks on their own homelands, right? Because they have their own nuclear arsenals. And also that because they are not the frontier states, yes, they have pretty diminished conventional armies, but their conventional armies are less salient to the immediate defense of NATO than further forward armies are, right? You know, so you can understand Poland not wanting to send a large part of its army to Ukraine, because, you know, Poland is itself a frontier state, right? Whereas it would be much longer before any kind of Russian conventional aggression arrived at the French border or somehow managed to invade the UK or whatever, even if that conceivably became possible. So that's kind of the case in favor. But you do still then run into a bunch of quite salient points that the army is so diminished, particularly in the UK, that if you think you're also going to be writing checks to reassure the Baltic states with that army or somehow reassuring the Scandinavian states of sort of British follow-on reinforcement or whatever, then there's only so many checks you can write with that rather diminished conventional army before all of the checks become wholly incredible, meant not in the sense of wow, that's incredible, but in the sense of not credible. And yeah, there's also then the other potential dimensions to that as well. So you know, let's say you try and put a really significant concentration of UK air power into places like Bulgaria and Romania to reinforce some commitment to Ukraine, or you were to move any kind of significant naval forces into the Black Sea under ceasefire type conditions and then try and support them there. Again, those things are then both targets and sort of pinned down in those places, right? So you can't have an edifice of, you know, the Royal Air Force is the main sort of contingency force for securing the skies and seas of Northwest Europe, you know, kind of Scandinavia and the Northeast Atlantic, if you also commit those forces down in Southeast Europe at the same time, you know, that they can only be in one place at so many times. And if they get destroyed, then they've ceased to be. So I think that there is some rather optimistic assumptions being made. I mean, you know, A, the ceasefire might happen, and B, you know, the force being proposed might turn out to be the Goldilocks spot, you know, just enough to reassure and deter without being the sort of all the major trade-offs and risks it brings. But that is quite a hopeful take.
I mean, the thing that would worry me is that, in particular, with regard to the Navy, is that we get a repeat of, let's say, Afghanistan and Iraq, where the army is committed to this never-ending commitment, let's say, like a revised version or a reconstituted version, sort of, but on a much smaller scale of the British Army of the Rhine. And so over a period of, what, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, when we should be investing in building up the RAF, the army and the navy, what we're doing is we're pouring money into a political project which Keir Starmer has come up with, which is this force in Ukraine, as well as any damage they might suffer, and the morale of the army sort of sucked into this morass. And so the rest of the UK armed forces are not built up because the money isn't made available, because it's all going to Ukraine, and the focus is not on the homeland defence of the UK. I mean, I agree we should support Ukraine the way that we can, and perhaps, as David M says, with the air power thing, but also the weaponry, etc., etc. But I do worry that it will become something that hobbles our actual NATO and homeland defence.
I think you're really spot on. But and I think the thing we need to do is go back to what is our grand strategy as a nation in terms of our strategic goals for the continuance of our economy and its defence. And when we do that, we return to being a sea power and we return to viewing our army as an expeditionary component that links us to Europe, but is not the core component. And therefore, just using that measure of strategic thinking, the involvement of ground troops so far forward in Central Europe is overextension and very dangerous.
But turning things slightly to a broader canvas, with Putin seemingly gaining the upper hand in Ukraine, and, you know, thanks to this new POWs Act with Trump, perhaps, we don't know which way that's going to go. Do you think, the pair of you, do you think that the Chinese are watching and having seen an invasion and land grab pay off for Moscow? Are we likely to see China launch its bid to take Taiwan sooner rather than later? I mean, David Aim, if you could start off with that.
So it's been a huge centerpiece of my work for 20 years is this big sort of rise and fall of empire dynamics in detail. And also a cycle which I call 108, 112 year hegemonic war cycle, which we entered into in 2022, which means we are only going to see escalation into the 2030 peak. And all of the pointers I think in front of us are the Chinese have set themselves up since 2020 in a 4 or 5 year plan like the Nazis did, and they're about to go bust or go to war. They've configured themselves for a maritime hegemony challenge across the Asian basin. So it isn't just Taiwan, it's all of it. And the barges they're building aren't just because they like barges with bridges. They're designed at the Mulberry Harvest for a purpose. They're not for deterrent, they're for invasion. So I think we live in this very critical phase right now where Xi every day balances, shall I, shan't I, exercises around Taiwan that used to be one division and 10 ships are now 42 divisions and 200 ships. And the US Pacific Command can't tell whether it's an exercise or the real thing as it's happening as we speak. So I think we really are on that cliff. And what's happening around Putin's continual manipulation of the West and the weakness we've shown is only encouragement to the aggressor. So I'm afraid that, you know, for those China hawks that sit there and want to denude Ukraine of support in the White House, they're fundamentally flawed because it's a linked enemy in a linked strategy. And no, they're not going to execute Kissinger too and surround China because they've firmed their alliance. And that results in a war across Asia. And the trigger point is Taiwan. It might not be Taiwan. It might be the other regions before Taiwan. But we are moving towards that inexorably right now.
And David B?
I share the sentiment that, or the assessment, that China desperately and earnestly wants and intends, if it can, to re-annex Taiwan. I don't know how much the performance of the Russians in Ukraine necessarily plays into that, right? I mean, that, you know, the lesson, the other lesson from Ukraine is that it's actually been ruinously costly and tremendously damaging to Russia's expensively reconstituted military, and actually it's performed pretty poorly. I mean, it's ground out some gains by throwing vast amounts of mass at it, both in terms of bodies and, you know, kind of 50 years worth of stockpiles of Soviet armor. It hasn't been a roaring success. And that's the relatively easy undertaking of crossing a land border, as opposed to trying to project power across a contested maritime strait. You know, the sort of the US logic of, you know, if we actually cut our support to Ukraine, then that helps Taiwan, for example, might be right in certain marginal places, right? So sending vast amounts of artillery shells to Ukraine is not super relevant to the Asia-Pacific theater, but actually if the Americans send less, for example, surface-to-air missiles to Ukraine, then those actually are relevant capabilities for the defense of Taiwan or the defense of the sort of Asian theater. So, you know, in that sense, trade-offs are real things. Even when you're the United States, then the more you put in one place, it necessarily means some amount of stuff you're not putting in some other place. So in that sense, I mean, whether it's kind of emboldening or not, it's a bit like the debate about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. You know, does this show that the West is weak and feckless and unable to sustain its commitments, or does it actually make sense to shed costly peripheral commitments that aren't going anywhere in order to double down on defending the things that matter to you most. And that somewhat depends on how it's interpreted by adversaries and your assessment of what those adversaries want. I mean, I broadly agree that, you know, the with the situation about China and Taiwan and China wanting regional hegemony in the Asia Pacific, I'm not sure they're necessarily massively emboldened or massively deterred by what they've seen in East Asia, in Eastern Europe, rather, because I suspect their interests in Asia were their interests anyway. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly been the case that China has seen a lot of value in keeping Russia going to the extent that it has, right, as a way of miring Western power in Eastern Europe. You know, so China has found that very useful. So provide enough support to the Russians that you don't get yourself into a direct war with NATO, but that you keep the Russians fighting in a way that keeps the US and Europeans pouring money and weapons into Eastern Europe has worked really well for China. But yeah, whether it's actually the thing that has somehow changed Chinese interests or whether they have those interests in annexing Taiwan anyway, I suspect they probably have those interests anyway.
And if I just segue for a second, and I'm sure we'll come back to the Chinese element when I mention this, but it is interesting to see the muscular approach adopted by the Trump administration to the Houthis with concerted attacks by US Navy carrier jets and cruise missiles on them. And it seems to me with all that firepower and munitions being expended, you know, cruise missiles in particular, to be against the priority that the Trump administration seems to have of facing down China. Because every missile, as you've sort of suggested there, David B, every missile expended against the Houthis is one less for use against the Chinese. So do you two feel that this is an example of the Trump administration reacting to events in a muscular way that it thinks it must to play whack-a-mole, you know, in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, rather than actually stopping and carefully husbanding its missile stocks to deter China? So, David M., if you'd like to start off with that.
Well, let's just frame what's going on in the Red Sea around Iran. Iran is one of the spokes that comes out of the Chinese alliance, and it's cross-referenced to Russia. And it conducted a war against Israel, created a proxy force and the Sword of Damocles, which the Israelis have unraveled, you know, very effectively and skillfully, I would add. But one of the casualties has been American maritime dominance. And if you want to be a maritime hegemony, you need to keep the sea lanes open. And what we've seen is a demonstration of anti-ship ballistic weapons with very small optical sensors, very simple ones, closing the Red Sea because the US doesn't effectively have enough escorts. Now, that's very like blitzkrieg as practiced in the Spanish Civil War. It's a precursor of a new form of warfare. And as far as the Chinese are concerned, it's extremely encouraging because they put their weight behind anti-ship ballistic missiles and saturation attacks from DF-21s to 26s, and one day I think DF-41s too, actually, which are going to reach the coast of San Francisco. And they've added DF-17s, which are hypersonic. And that ability has basically given them the overnight skill set to destroy US and Japanese forces in very short order. And they've seen a demonstration of very basic versions of those systems close a sea lane. So the humiliation is massive to America. Trump also has a desire to show strength when he's been pummeled by Putin, because he must know he's been manipulated somewhere, and it's an easy, basically, win. But the third piece of this puzzle is Iran is making a nuclear breakout. It's quite amazing to me that it hasn't happened earlier. It's going for nuclear weapons, which, as we could imagine, would be pretty difficult in the region. And so I think Trump feels it's easy to start with the Houthis, because if you can operate against the Gulf, because the net result of these strikes, which the Iranians can't stop, is going to be they're going to try and close the Gulf. And that means you don't want the Houthis at your back. So I see it as phase one of an operation to destroy Iran's nuclear capabilities in the near future. And in fact, even it's very, very logical. And you're right about the loss of missile systems. And the other part of it, it also brings the US fleet within range of the DF-26s in the Western Chinese desert. And a naval concentration always worries me when you've got the duality of one in the Asian basin and one in the Gulf. So there's a different scenario that I think we should be concerned about.
Before we switch to David B there, just to clarify what you said just there, do you mean that the Americans with whatever plan they have in mind for Iran, are they going to close the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf?
No. The Iranians will close it in response.
Right.
It's one of the few things they can do. You're looking at a regime which is on the back foot. It's lost its access, crescent Shia access. It's lost all its relationships, and the regime sits on its only chance is to have nuclear weapons. If that's defied, they'll become even more extreme and try and close the Gulf with small boats and all the difficulties that go with it and drones. And there'll be a battle around that, a concentration of U.S. naval forces, obviously. And that also brings about the issue of whether China chooses that to be the moment. So we are like a world sitting on a stack of dynamite, and there are a number of fuses, and they're all lit right now. Whether it's an issue about Ukraine, whether it's Iran or the Asian issue, all those fuses are very much alight.
So you meant that it was the Americans having the foresight to see that when the Iranians, let's say, eventually do their thing and close the Strait of Hormuz to damage the world economy, etc., that the Americans saw that if they had to respond to that, they didn't want the Houthis behind them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very logical step-by-step part of a bigger campaign, which is well overdue if you can just assess where the IAEA is talking about the number of units of enriched uranium the Iranians have. And we must assume that technology was swapped for the Shia drones by the Russians, and that's probably miniaturization technology. And on top of that, they prove they have basic hypersonic weapons that penetrated the Iron Dome, so they don't have to build a large number of warheads to be a threat to Israel. It's a very, very dangerous cocktail.
And David P., what do you think to the whole Houthi thing and what David said just there about the looming conflict with Iran?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's a lot of very important, insightful points in there. I mean, certainly how Iran's proxies and conventional weapons have performed against Israel in the last 18 months. I suspect, without being a deep Iran expert, but you don't really have to be to figure out that will have kind of terrified them because they thought they had this elaborate network of kind of both conventional weapons, terrorist proxies, things like that, and the Israelis have performed quite well at dismantling those things. I mean, obviously, the Israelis have also made themselves a bunch of other regional enmities along the way, you know, through some of the other aspects of their behavior. But certainly, if you were Iran, you'd be quite concerned right now. And that will have intensified their interest in nuclear weaponry. Whether they ultimately make the choice to fully rush for breakout or continue sort of tinkering with the edges of nuclear latency, as they have done, you know, some of the literature on nuclear proliferation is quite interesting, right? Because, you know, it's one of the things that constrains it is thinking your assessment of whether you can get there, get to the point of having not just an atomic bomb, but an actual survivable nuclear arsenal that then generates meaningful deterrence before your adversaries can disarm you. And that's obviously been the main sort of challenge obstacle for Iran that has sort of kept it more in the latency space for quite a while. But, you know, as I say, you know, that they may now have some different thoughts going on because of how poorly their conventional weapons and their proxies have performed. And obviously, you know, other David is also right that the Houthis are one of those important Iranian proxies, in some ways the one that has performed better than the others. I mean, obviously, they're, you know, in a slightly different context and all the rest of it. But yeah, so there is that dimension to it. I don't know, you know, quite how the Americans certainly have a long-standing interest in trying to weaken and peg the Iranians back. Whether this proves to be the opening salvos of a broader anti-Iran campaign, I don't know. I'm not really in the sort of forecasting business, not anymore anyway. But it's certainly the case that that could be one logic. I mean, another logic is just that the Trump administration craves the domestic political benefits of of projecting strength, of kind of beating up on relatively beat upable adversaries, which isn't to say they don't deserve beating up on, I hasten to add. So in that sense, there might be some sort of domestic political rationale. Certainly, if people are going around saying you're so weak in the face of Putin or whatever, then it could be a way of projecting strength in other ways. So I think there certainly is a sound strategic logic to an anti-Houthi campaign. The question is whether you end up expending more munitions or becoming more entangled in such a deep commitment, or a commitment that's so deep that it outweighs the benefit, the interest, whatever. So that really is the trade-off here. I mean, as a cursory, you know, as a sort of sidebar, really, but for the UK, if it is intending to do Operation Highmast into that region, as was in the public domain as certainly being the plan, you know, and if that remains the plan, then having the Americans kind of pulverize Houthi anti-shipping forces might actually be quite a welcome development for the UK, given the sort of slightly squeaky bums, butterfly tummies, whatever it is, the UK might have had about sending, say, HMS Prince of Wales through that region. So it'd be really nice if the Americans took out all the Houthi anti-ship missiles just beforehand.
Yeah, and I suppose, and hopefully we can, if and when HMS Prince of Wales goes through that area, through the Bab el Mandeb, the Red Sea into the Gulf of Aden, that the Americans will still remain our friends and provide some of the cover for that. Seeing as the carrier's going to Indo-Pacific anyway. But going the other way, what do the two of you think about the prospect of, let's say, the Chinese Navy one day doing what it has just done to New Zealand and Australia, which is to sail around, do a circumnavigation, I think, of Australia and go through between New Zealand and Australia, through the Tasman Sea and do live firing. Are we one day going to see Chinese aircraft carriers or task groups that do more than just go to the St. Petersburg Navy Day and actually sail around the UK or Europe? What do you think, David M?
Well, I remember when that first Chinese frigate came through the Suez Canal to rescue Chinese nationals in Libya. And I'd been warning for almost a decade that the Chinese Navy would become a blue water navy and project itself into the oceans. And that was the first manifestation. I think the strategic purpose of surrounding Australia is really huge, because if we could interview, I've often thought, the admirals in the Japanese Navy and say, you know, what went wrong with your plans for World War II? They would say, we lost the Battle of the Coral Sea and we didn't take Australia. And from Australia, America mounted the fight back, which came back at us north. And if they hadn't, and we'd excluded them from the Pacific Basin, the tyranny of distance would have preserved our empire. And the Chinese have learned from that. So this wasn't just a hollow gesture. This is a statement of intent that when they start their war, they will ensure they take New Zealand and Australia. And currently, I don't think, you know, the other side is looking very good in terms of holding them back. Once that happens, and I think we have to really accept once, the shipbuilding, all global maritime hegemonies are based on shipbuilding capabilities. The Royal Navy was built on Portsmouth, being a steam producer, and produced more than the French could. The Royal Navy did that for 100 years, and the American Navy's been doing that for 70 years and did in the Second World War. The Chinese building ships on a capacity and the way they are now doing portends, they are challenging for the seven oceans. And we're talking about a number of ships and capabilities of ships that are beyond our means at the moment, especially if we lose the South Korean and Japanese shipyards. So yes, I think there's a real danger. The real danger over the next 10 years is this migrates from an Asian basin grab to a consolidation to literally an expansion across the world's oceans by the Chinese Navy. And it's not just numbers, it's also their technology and capabilities. And they've learned a great deal by watching the Russians go to war against Ukraine. They've learned about adaptation. They've learned about the way technology has to be cycled shorter and shorter to beat your enemies. And I'm constantly amazed at the level of new technologies the Chinese manifest. For example, they made a railgun work when the Americans gave up in 2021. They're creating a subsea radar system that detects planes above the waters. You know, they've got SALSA systems like we do, which are networked rather than cabled. Every part of that technology race, we're not looking so good at, and they're winning the AI battle, in a command and control system for war. So we are really in trouble. And yes, I do. I think our oceans are in threat and our navies are our prime defence.
David B?
I broadly agree. I mean, you know, at the moment, the West's maritime lead remains relatively robust, you know, with some important caveats in the sense of certainly when it comes to maritime power projection, things like SSN capabilities, you know, the China and Russia would dearly love to have SSNs or SSBNs that were as good as Western ones, or certainly, you know, and the challenges involved in sort of complex carrier power projection, you know, not just building large flat top grey ships, but actually making aircraft carriers work as kind of integrated forces, are some places where the West still has some important advantages. And it's also true that power degrades with distance, right? In exactly the same way that the UK is a much less consequential naval power when it strains to project a carrier group into the Western Pacific, compared to when, you know, UK naval forces remain sort of concentrated in the Northeast Atlantic. So, you know, that's the slightly glass half full kind of account that, you know, even a country with the resource base of China, its power will diminish the further it projects it. And it still has some areas where it's not a match of Western powers. But of course, the glass half empty account is that, you know, as other David rightly points out, you know, that China is spectacularly outbuilding, you know, the combined West when it comes to naval power. You know, if it can establish hegemony in the Western Pacific and, you know, reach the point where it is robustly confident that it can push the US out of that theatre, then it can turn its gaze further afield. Of course, we've long sort of thought about, you know, projecting, you know, from the Western Pacific to the Atlantic as being a very long undertaking, but with climate change and the sort of thawing of the Northern Sea route, you know, if China is an ally of Russia, then suddenly you have a whole new route, pretty much straight from the sort of Northwest Pacific into the Northeast Atlantic. You know, if China does reach the point where it's much more secure and happy and confident in its hegemony in its own region, then it will have much more scope to project power into other regions to try and advance its interests there, especially if it's in conjunction with cooperating with a Russian ally. You know, that doesn't mean Russia and China are always destined to remain the best of friends, right? You know, they've had a fraught relationship in the past. But as long as their interests remain broadly aligned, which at the moment they do seem to, then that's another sort of vector by which that cooperation and that power projection might happen. And then, yeah, you might find yourself much more in a situation where the UK imagining projecting power to the Gulf or the Indo-Pacific or whatever really is dealing with two hostile great powers projecting naval force into the Northeast Atlantic, you know, and that really will then have some quite big implications for how the UK configures its forces.
And just to take that on a bit, with the Labour government announcing plans to supposedly boost defence in a major way and prepared to cut welfare to pay for an upgraded military, how do each of you think the Royal Navy should mould itself to reach the new level and to take on that challenge? David M., first of all.
Well, first of all, yes, I do think our social spending has to be constrained significantly, but we also need to use war loans to essentially put capital into our defences and have a 5% capital. I believe we should be at 5% of a capital spend to make up for the deficit in our spending programmes, which I'll talk about in a minute, because it's the integral under the spending programme over a given time that gives you capability, and we have a very small area under that integral in effect. And we need to be at 5%, you know, for conventional forces per annum, because we are on a war footing, not just to face off against Russia, but this rising Chinese threat, which I see joining the Russians at a critical moment, much sooner than people contemplate in our defence planning. In terms of what the Navy, I think, and the constitution of the Navy, it needs to have, its prime goal is the control of the northern approaches and the Atlantic and the bridge to continental America. So in that respect, what do we need to do it? We need coastal forces like Swedish Vissé-class corvettes and German type 212 submarines, which are diesel electrics or air independence. We need a force that literally controls and protects our local domains of seaways. We then need an offensive power projection force, which is, you know, what our carriers could be if they were properly armed with aeroplanes with the right missile systems and self-protection mechanisms and escorts to then go and block the northern approaches. And then we need forces, which we've given away with Bulwark and Albion, to project our maritime capability, because it isn't just about sea power now with the range of these with missiles and access denial systems. It's all of the islands that prepare the route to the Barents Sea that we need to control, because the Russians start sticking just ground forces with SAMs and basically surface-to-surface missiles, they'll control huge areas. It's one of the reasons why Greenland is relevant, because if you control the Greenland coast, you project into that gap. So we need to build far more capably a surface fleet that has carriers that can protect themselves. And, you know, I think it's absolutely sinful that, you know, if you look at a French carrier, it has an Aster 15 missile system, and yet our carriers have the same radars as a Type 45, and we're missing the ability to self-defend them and to be a force multiplier. So lethality has to be our prime first move. We stack our ships up, we make them work properly, and we put as much lethality on them as possible. I also think that instead of building, because one of the problems is magazine depth, which the Americans have had to face in the Pacific, and they've obviously been working on one route, but I think there's another route, and that is quite simply we build arsenal ships, simple autonomous ships that go alongside a warship with the sensor platforms and increase the number of launch cells. That's something we could do very quickly that then suddenly force multiplies our ability to deploy capability. And so we need to also, at the same time, we need to bear in mind we are missile defenseless. We've seen in Israel and we've seen in Ukraine, if you can't defend your homeland and your operational bases from missile attack, you're not going to be able to project any power. So the primary goal we need right now is a proper missile shield. That missile shield stretches from Arrow 3s for high-level interception, David Slings or Patriots or SAMP-Ts with the proper radar systems, point defense systems like SkySaber, and also SHORAD systems, as we've seen from 40mm Geopards and Sky Rangers. But we have to invest in that, because without an operation space, we can't even protect our seas and power. And they are our immediate priorities right now. And we need to really impress upon our leaders that it's all very well leading the free European world, as we have done, but that makes us number one target. And at the moment, we've made ourselves a number one target, and we've consistently made ourselves weaker in the process. So I'm a huge fan of the army as a power projection mechanism to link us to Europe. But right now, we do need to put our own defense and homeland security before anything else. That's missile defense, air power, and a much, much larger and more lethal navy.
And David B., what's your take on all that?
Yeah, I think I violently agree with much of it, actually. So the points about missile defenses are something, you know, I published a paper in the Naval Review last year that, you know, sort of spoke a bit about this, you know, and sort of conceiving as those of part of the maritime battle, which, you know, is not always super intuitive for people. But when we think about vulnerabilities of UK command and control in particular, and how we've basically sort of grown our maritime posture during the post-Cold War based on the premise of, you know, power projection being a thing you use the sea for, the assumption that the sea is basically secured for you by Western, you know, brackets American power, and the sea is therefore a sort of highway along which you travel to go and do power projection to, you know, Middle Eastern rogue states or whatever that can't really shoot back, and it's fine to just drop gravity bombs on them from F-35s or whatever, because this is what war looks like. And, you know, things like command and control are sort of premised on that, you know. So, you know, places like Northwood headquarters, you know, which are sort of, you know, just sort of modern office buildings, you know. And yeah, sure, you know, there are other facilities there and stuff as well. But so you do have a bunch of sort of implications for things like, you know, missile defense is not just a nice thing to have for protecting your population, and indeed, you know, trying to do protection for the whole population, similar to sort of Israel's kind of conception, might be really hard in a territory as sort of long and sprawling as the UK. But particularly when it comes to removing or lessening adversaries' escalation incentives, or giving yourself the ability to sort of fight and survive and hopefully ultimately thrive if it does come to war, then missile defenses around, you know, command and control, logistical hubs, you know, sort of key air bases and things like that become central, not just as a nice thing for air defense in its own right, but also central to your broader ability to sustain a maritime theater war. Then when, you know, to come to some of David's other points, yeah, absolutely. You know, we, again, as a product of that post-Cold War unipolar moment of American dominance, you know, there's been a lot of Western talk about anti-access and area denial as things that other people are trying to do to us. But it's actually things that we may ourselves find ourselves needing to do for ourselves, right? Especially if the Americans are less committed or are distracted elsewhere or whatever. So things like increasing the lethality of basically everything that floats, not just presuming that you can have this neat high-low mix between some super Gucci frigates that are the things that are assumed to do war, which is a bounded separate space, versus OPVs that are assumed to just do patrol in, you know, neat, benign conditions. You know, in an era of sort of pervasive great power competition, there isn't a neat distinction between those are the benign places and those are the warry places. You know, unfortunately, the whole world looks pretty contested. So basically, everything that floats having some kind of lethal capabilities. You know, absolutely submarine forces. You know, obviously the Royal Navy is making interesting strides on sort of autonomous submarine technology at the moment. But I agree with other David that actually, you know, if you wanted to really get serious about controlling the Northeast Atlantic for yourself, not relying on others doing it for you, then some sort of diesel electric, more affordable submarine option beyond simply SSNs. You know, because the SSNs are wonderful, but they're so scarce, you know, and they're so overstretched, you know. You know, that's all sort of in the public domain, you know, the amount of, you know, people who try and tot up force availability and things saying, you know, these things are being worked very hard, and we don't have enough of them. So yeah, absolutely, hunter-killer submarines. Having carrier groups that could be really powerful tools of sea control, but, you know, at the moment they don't have a meaningful anti-ship or land strike missile. You know, the basic premise is kind of they can do their own air defense, so which is sort of self-licking, you know, they can protect themselves, and drop gravity bombs on, you know, sort of minor adversaries is not really any kind of meaningful capability at all. So yeah, absolutely, shifting to a concept of being able to generate sea and air control over the Northeast Atlantic for yourselves without recourse to anyone else, without a bunch of baked in assumptions about the Americans doing this and that for you, that really ought to be the priority.
And so summing up where we've travelled during the course of this podcast, with one final question from me, just to be the agent provocateur or whatever. Do you think, the two of you, that we're heading inexorably towards what the tabloids frequently call World War III, or, you know, is it in reality a global war that's over the horizon? Can we avoid it? Or do you think it's going to happen no matter what? So starting with you, David M.
I'm afraid I would argue that World War III started in 2022 with the invasion of Ukraine. And the logic behind that answer is that under my study, I have created these model empire systems that allowed me to predict 20 years ago that we would be at that point in 2022. And it represents America's terminal decline within the construct of the Western Christian empires. And the opposition has risen in the form of a superation system, first the Japanese and now the Chinese. It's much easier to see them as a continuum because it isn't just a one-off challenge. It's a systematic regional challenge. But there's another element that's really important. You don't just need a decline and rise to create Thilimidu's trap. You basically also need another thing. And one of the most surprising things about my research is there is a hegemonic war cycle between 108 and 112 years. And that cycle seems to pump entropy into collective systems and that creates chaos and it catalyzes the conflict that's rising. So it goes back to when the French challenged the Spanish. It goes back to the war and the Napoleonic Wars that started, obviously, in 1798. The peak of that cycle was 08 and it ended in 1815. It goes back to 1914 and the peak of that cycle was 1920 and it didn't end until 1945. So the way to think about this is when two systems, one is declining and one rises, this external dynamic catalyzes a war. And the war is often within 8 years of the entropic peak, which is 2030. So it's just 2020 is about right. And it only ever gets worse. It only escalates and it only builds and it only ends when a new form of challenge is either wins or loses. So Germany, for example, lost and Britain lost in defending, and up came America and up came the Soviet Union. Britain became the hegemony after the Napoleonic Wars. The French became the hegemon after the Spanish. So we have started this battle for hegemony. It's kinetic because the magnitude of the war in Ukraine with 1.5 million casualties matches it. It's in two regions with the Middle East at the same time. And the only part that is missing now is what happens with China at the core challenging methodology. So we need to really realize this is only going to get worse. And historically, the evidence is overwhelming. It started 3 years ago, and we wasted 3 years of Ukrainian blood and treasure in not responding and raising our defenses, which have made it more likely to become true.
But I would say to you, David, if I may, David Murrin, David M, before David B gives his take on that, the two Davids, right, sorting you out. I would say that it all surely depends on China, Russia, North Korea, Venezuela, whoever, the Houthis, and Iran, all remaining in agreement. It's a bit like the thing in Austin Powers where you've got Dr. Evil and his table full of all the various bad actors as they were 30 years ago. And it's, you know, are they all going to get around the table in somebody's lair and agree, or will they diverge and fall out and not have the same objectives, you know?
Well, we've all been on the playground, and playground dynamics are people ally with the two strongest people in the playground. And right now, China is, if you were Putin, you would back staying with China, not America, because China's power is rising and America's clearly waning, as he preceded the conversation on the phone by saying. So it's really lovely that MAGA thinks we can execute a Kissinger too, but there's no way that Putin is going to leave the strongest bully on the playground, because ultimately he can see him winning. So no, I don't see that process. And I think because they've been very successful in terms of what's going on in Ukraine, the main strategic purpose, although militarily, as David said, it's not been a good look for the Russians, the main purpose was to fragmentate Europe from America and put a wedge between the two. And Putin has used Ukraine to do just that, as we now feel so acutely. So strategically, it's been immensely successful. So those things will only encourage people. I mean, when you're winning, you don't have fracturing. You have fracturing when you're losing. We're on the fracture side. They're on the patting each other backside. So I'm afraid I can't see that as a route to our redemption.
Okay. So when you say the biggest bully, you mean China, that you want to be on the... So with Trump alienating allies and throwing chaos around and undermining the solidarity of the West... China now looks like it's a better bet if you want to...
I don't actually. I think because we're so far down the kinetic route, we're not going to see people jumping into Chinese, into bed with China, so to speak, because there is a recognition we're really in the kinetic phase of threat. But what I'm sort of trying to say is that the allies that are in the spokes, the North Koreans, the Russians, the Iranians, their bond is only becoming stronger with China, not weaker. So, I can't see that split. And even if they did split off, the real deciding capability is China. The only country that would make a difference, if you could create Kissinger II, is you would take the resources of Russia and denude it, and you can hopefully constrain the sea lanes and create some constriction to the Chinese challenge. But I'm afraid I think that passed, and passed probably in 2020 when oil prices started to move up, because there's a correlation between the assimilation of wealth in the Soviets, in the Russian system, and the boldness of Putin's behavior. So we're in a commodity positive world right now. And this oil price right now, I think, is probably not going to last very long before the next impulse upwards because of the Gulf.
Just before we turn to the other David, when you say Kissinger 2, I think we ought to explain to listeners, you're referring to the rapprochement between Nixon's USA, led by his Secretary of State Kissinger, with China. Is that what you mean?
Yes. I mean, basically, there was a stage in the early phase of the Cold War where the two communist powers seemed to be close to each other. And indeed, you know, the Chinese and Mao wanted nuclear weapons and gave grains back to the Russians. So the idea, and Kissinger's brilliant idea, was to juice China away from Russia and isolate Russia as one enemy rather than two. So this process at the moment with the MAGA followers is really what Trump's brilliant plan is to try and seduce Putin away from China, because it's the reverse process of Kissinger too, and you isolate the enemy. But it isn't going to happen. It would have happened if we'd done it 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, perhaps there was a chance. But I believe we're too far down that kinetic pipe for that to change right now.
Right. So, David B., what do you reckon to the prospect of World War III, and can we avoid it?
Yeah, I think, just to respond to one of other David's points first, the point about the Russia-China alignment. It's interesting, right? So when we think about, you know, often... You know, there's, you know, the literature about, you know, do states balance against power or do they balance against threat? You know, and sort of balance of power theory is very simple. But then we have all these historical examples of states not balancing against the strongest power, you know, determining that their most acute threat comes from somewhere else. And that's quite interesting, right? You know, because a simple balance of power theory, if China is still the ascendant rising power, would say that Russia ought to be starting to get jitters about the ascent of its neighbor, right? They've had some pretty fraught relations in the past. And given that the base of Russian power is not all that healthy in terms of their demographics and their sort of waning of their manufacturing sector and things like that, then, you know, living next door to a country that's as big and on its way to being as rich and developed as China could give you a really jittery stomach. But then when we look more at sort of how states interpret threat, you know, power is only one input to that. And so, you know, providing Moscow continues to not really see Beijing as posing a meaningful threat to its interests, and seeing the West as posing a more severe threat to Russian interests, then I sort of agree with other David that alignment is likely to remain reasonably strong, even as Chinese relative power grows vis-a-vis Russia, precisely because the Russians see us, the West, or whatever, as posing more of a threat to their interests, even though our power isn't really rising at the moment. The broader question of, you know, are we on our way to World War III? I mean, obviously, there's already a great power war going on, you know, in the sense that, okay, yes, at the start of the war, Ukraine was probably not a major power, if you like, or maybe I should have said major power war rather than great power war. You know, all these things are slightly semantic. But the amount of transfers of money and weapons to Ukraine have basically made it into a European major power. So in that sense, there is a major power war happening in Europe right now. You know, which also has a proxy element of lots of other outside major powers backing the various parties. So in that sense, there's a great power war going on right now. I think, you know, that probably, you know, China's interest in annexing Taiwan is so acute. And indeed, you know, windows of opportunity are really dangerous things in international relations. You know, if people think they have a now or never type moment, and certainly if China does reach the point where it feels it's built up sufficient amphibious forces and all the rest of it for the operation to be viable, but that Taiwan hasn't yet meaningfully matched that in terms of its own denial capabilities or whatever, or indeed if it thinks it has a moment of kind of, you know, lessened US commitment or a divided West or whatever, then that combination of China thinks it can do it, China really wants to do it, and might be the sort of really toxic combo in East Asia. You know, and at that point, the US would have to make the decision of, does it want to fight a big theater war with China, or does it want to concede the point, sort of say, well, Taiwan, we always sort of thought it was a bit of China anyway, and therefore or sort of let it go in the hope that China only has limited ambitions, you know, concede this one point in the hope that that then basically a sort of spheres of influence type logic. I don't think I'm quite as sort of deterministic or fatalistic or whatever as other David, because, you know, it's a sort of old cliche, you know, the enemy has a vote. You know, in this sense, we are the enemy of those other parties. And, you know, if we do deterrence well enough, you know, if we do some of the things we've been talking about, you know, Russia is not a power equal to the Western European major powers in terms of its wealth, its technology, whatever. So if we get really serious about defense, then there is reasonable prospects of not making Russia into some benign, cuddly sort of, you know, New Zealand with lots of gas sort of thing, but just causing them to conclude that right now there's nothing they can really do about Western European power. And, you know, if you can keep making them make that same choice every day for 100 years, then you know you've done quite well. So I think it's fair to say that we are already in an era of great power conflict, great power competition. Whether it becomes, how big it becomes, does depend on the success of our deterrent postures.
Right. I think we'll conclude it there. That's been a fascinating, illuminating, alarming, whatever you want to call it, discussion. But I thank you for your insights, and hope that we can somehow dodge the bullet, the ballistic bullet that's coming. And anyway, all adds to hopefully people out there listening to the Warships Pod and being educated and illuminated in whatever their decisions are, if there are decision makers listening, which I hope there are. So thank you to both of you, Davids, to both gentlemen, David and the other David, for coming on Warships Pod.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.